Welcome to Epilogue, Press TV's review programme, where we look at books that probe the biggest problems in the world today and tell us if international policies to overcome those problems have any hope of working. I'm Martin Short, and today here in London, we're reviewing The Political Economy of Narcotics by Julia Buxton. Julia, the author, is with me now. She's a senior research fellow in the Centre for International Cooperation and Security at the University of Bradford. Also here is Harry Shapiro, a writer and journalist who has written many books on drugs, on popular music, and on the overlap between drugs and music. He is director of communications for the UK's major drugs charity, Drugscope. Well, we're doing this book because there's no real bigger issue in world social affairs, at least, than the narcotics trade and the fact that all over the world lots of people, unfortunately, are addicted to substances which can destroy their lives. But, Julia, that wasn't the attitude in the 19th century, was it? All these drugs were legal then.
Absolutely. We have this very long history of unregulated use of what are known today as narcotic substances. They were used for a variety of reasons, self-medication being the leading factor. And it was only really towards the end of the 19th century that we see moves towards regulation, largely in the United Kingdom. But it was a real push by the United States to go for a completely different drug strategy, anti-drug strategy, prohibition, that's transformed the nature of the drugs trade.
You're going a bit ahead of me here, because I was really fascinated by the fact that most of these items, notably opium, which in its chemical forms becomes morphine and then later heroin, and also cocaine, and to some extent cannabis, they're actually medical prescriptions. Most of them were developed for medical use. What do you think of that, Harry?
Well, yes, that's absolutely true. I mean, medical science progressed quite dramatically during the 19th century. They discovered how to extract morphine from opium poppies. They discovered how to extract cocaine from coca leaf. And they also developed the hypodermic syringe as well during the same period, which clearly had a fairly dramatic impact on how these drugs could be administered.
And they went fairly rapidly from purely medical uses to recreational uses. I mean, certainly by the end of the 19th century, it's quite recreational, isn't it?
Not really. I think there was still a predominance of the medical use of drugs. Recreational use was a very kind of limited forum for drug use at that period.
But also, of course, it was a matter of international trade. I mean, I'm going back a bit earlier here with the opium trade, which was used by the British to break open China for British goods, notably opium produced in India. I mean, it's an amazing reversal of international trade, isn't it? That whereas today we condemn countries for producing opium in particular, then we thought it was generally a good thing.
Oh, absolutely. In the 18th century, you have the British desperate to get into China, which was this huge market, but it was closed to outside trading. And for the British, a route into the Chinese market was through opium, which the Chinese tried to block repeatedly. But the British really wanted to get a foothold in there so that we could obtain Chinese silk and tea. And the way we did that was through essentially pirating opium into China, opium that was produced in India. And the revenues that that the British made from the opium trade was used essentially to sustain empire. About 25% of the administrative costs of empire in India was from the opium trade.
So it was rather appropriate, I suppose, that the royal family were quite avid consumers of various forms of narcotics.
In line with most people, they self-medicated with cannabis, according to reports in The Lancet, and that was, it was common for narcotic drugs to be used in that way, so it wouldn't have been controversial at that period in time. Queen Victoria was a regular cannabis user, according to The Lancet.
So, I mean, Harry, as we look at this book, and I mean, I'm sure you know about these issues generally, we find that suddenly in the 1910s, a drive comes for prohibition. What on earth brought this about?
I think, I mean, basically what happened is there's a kind of broader issue here. It wasn't just about drugs. It was the whole business of America as a burgeoning world power and wanting to, I suppose, kind of project its own kind of moral agenda, which it had at home. There was a very strong temperance movement in the United States. There was lots of moves to deal with prostitution and all kinds of social ills that America was suffering because of the explosion in the populations in urban areas. And you had this kind of sort of frontier mentality, really, that America wanted to take the moral high ground in a number of different areas internationally, and one of those was drugs, because they occupied, I think it was the Philippines, as the result of some international, as an international war, and they got to the Philippines and found that there was a major opium problem there. Mm. Realized they had a similar problem on their own back door, and that kind of just promulgated this whole idea that of international narcotics as an issue.
And again, in your book, you produce evidence from this Philippines Commission, which was far stronger against narcotics than, for instance, the Royal Commission in Britain. But what I noticed from your book is that drugs in particular becomes confounded with a kind of morality. It's the morality issue that screws things up, isn't it? I mean, with cigarettes, it's not a good thing because it gives you cancer, or we know that now. And alcohol, well, you may become violent. Mm-hmm. But those really aren't moral issues. Well, the moral issue somehow overcomes not the issue of the narcotics legalization or criminalization, because in America, it seems they're particularly worried that black men are going to go around raping white women.
The moral aspects of it, as Harry said, was very important, because President McKinley at the time, when the Americans inherited the Philippines after the Spanish-American War, for President McKinley, this became a mission to civilize the people of the Philippines, and the anti-opium campaign was part of that. There was a strong morality kind of spine, backbone to this campaign in the United States, as Harry said, from the alcohol prohibition movement. But at the same time, there was some realpolitik on the part of the United States, because they were also desperate to get into the Chinese market as well. And so a way of kind of getting close to the Chinese was by taking a very strong line against opium, which was the position of the Chinese emperor at the time. But drugs really, it wasn't a big issue in the United States at that period. So the way that the American government really built popular support for its anti-drugs campaign was the use of profoundly racist, stereotyped images of drugs users, which was typically Chinese people with opium and Afro-Americans with cocaine. Completely exaggerated imagery, but ones which were very potent in America during a period of real turmoil and racial tension.
Now, the main act in America relating to drug prohibition, I think, was the Harrison Act, mm-hmm. in 1914, followed 5 years later by the Volstead Act, which banned the production, sale and distribution of alcohol. And so we get these two forms of prohibition sort of spiraling into each other, don't we? Mm-hmm. And here we have something that you've said, as we've heard, all the major drugs of choice were legal in the 19th and early 20th centuries, but then they were outlawed with disastrous consequences, largely because the prohibitionists wholly misread human nature, a mistake they are still making today.
Prohibition is a utopian objective, and it has led the control apparatus to set unrealistic goals that it repeatedly fails to achieve. Demand for drugs has persisted throughout the history of the international drug prohibition regime. This is despite the threat of harsh punishment, ranging from a long prison sentence to execution for the possession of controlled substances. If demand persists, it will be met by supply, as was demonstrated by the alcohol prohibition experience in the USA in the 1920s. The supply of drugs is attributed to the high level of profit that can be generated from the provision of illicit substances. For as long as the substance in demand remains illicit, it will be profitable to engage in supply.
Harry, what do you think of Julia's analysis? Do you think that ultimately prohibition simply won't work, because when a substance becomes illegal, the market forces will take over, and people will be prepared to pay far more for what is then an illegal substance?
Yeah. I mean, we've there's the history of us as a species and our interaction with these kinds of, this goes back thousands of years, isn't just into the 19th century, and there's a very long history of people's desire to change their consciousness in all sorts of different ways, either for medical reasons or recreational reasons. And I think that prohibition, I suppose it depends what your starting point is, and if the idea of prohibition is to stop people from taking drugs, then it was always going to be doomed to failure. And that's the situation where we're in now.
I mean, it seems as if where there's the law has no role when on one side there's a product that people want and on the other side there's people willing to supply it. Mm. I mean it, in that sense, the market will always win.
And the problem is as well with prohibition, you can never win because of the fundamental logic of how the market works. And you can suppress the production of cannabis or the cultivation of coca leaves, but the problem is once you suppress it, because there's a shortage, that leads to an increase in the price. And as soon as the price goes up, then that brings in new producers and new suppliers and traffickers into the market. So you're trapped in an ever-decreasing circle of defeat. You can never win the war on drugs.
Well, and not only that, you also tell in the book the story of how by the 80s America is engaging in militarized campaigns where you put the army into the destruction of supplies of narcotics, particularly initially, at least in South America. Mm-hmm. I think mm-hmm. I mean, the extraordinary thing that you actually send troops in to destroy cocaine, coca leaves.
Well, I think this really shows the response. It really began in the 1970s with Nixon trying to paraquat spray cannabis production in Mexico. Now, the United States really, in turning to these intensively militarized strategies, really that's, to my mind, that's an admission that previous policies have failed. So you're increasing the violence around the drug trade in a further effort to suppress it. And South America, you know, the United States has always seen South America as its backyard. So transposing these militarized politics to contexts like Bolivia and Colombia, where we now have this appalling war on drugs, where we have aerial spraying of coca leaf production, all that served to do is to increase the amount of cocaine that's being produced and actually reduce the price of cocaine. It's been a completely ineffective counter-drugs conflict, counter-drugs war. Which has had terrible human rights and human and ecological costs. The militarization strategy simply cannot work. It just causes more problems.
Harry, what do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think Julie made the point earlier about kind of realpolitik. I think there's also a realpolitik now, and I can't believe for one minute the American federal government believes that it can wipe out drugs, that it can, destroy opium and coca forever. There is another political agenda here about foreign influence, about aid, about geopolitical diplomacy. It's a complicated matrix where foreign policy and drug policy have become intertwined, mm-hmm. so that you use one in order to prosecute the other one, and that's what
I mean, with an ultimate catastrophe for American foreign policy. I mean, it seems extraordinary that, as you say, ever since the Monroe Doctrine, America has regarded South and Latin America as its backyard, but its interdiction, its military actions in South America have actually turn things against them. I mean, it's extraordinary, which, you, as you say in the book here, we've got a coca producer, practically, a cocalero, at least, Evo Morales, who has managed to really overturn the entire American strategy. He's now president of Bolivia, and basically he's the representative of a peasant economy which is based in large part on coca leaf production.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is one of the kind of main factors that I tried to explore in the book, was the challenges of globalization and how since the collapse of the Cold War the drugs trade has thrived and developed. And what you see in the kind of post-Cold War period is neoliberal economics being applied in countries like Bolivia, which caused enormous levels of unemployment and forced peasants into coca production. Evo Morales grew out of the political confrontations between the Bolivian government, being sponsored by the US, and peasant producers. People are driven into the production and cultivation of these drugs out of poverty, and violence to try and suppress that is not an answer to the dynamics that sustain this trade.
Well, I want to now transfer the conversation to Afghanistan, and we have some film here, which comes from the Senless Council, which shows how ruthless drug control programs driven by the flawed notion of prohibition, can have serious consequences for those countries where the raw drug is produced, especially today in Afghanistan, where the destruction of opium poppies just before they were to be harvested can reduce farmers to absolute poverty.
كم كم يسوق وكري أخذنا لازم وكري سر كله ورمات كطول ما أدري فبس قريب أني وبس قريب كبير كني نص ترياك نص كنا يعني
دخلك ترياك شو نتيجة
واه
بدي نتيجة وركي ده كاري هذا شكرنا
ده ده خنو كار فدي أنا ده شيء واجب أول فدي أفغانستان خلوا بس لا يكاسن ده شيء كري شيء وثبات خبر واركي أو بس ده بنشدو نش ما تيكي واجي ورجو أغنى سجل بيعنا وركي واجي ورجو إنه كده أفغانستان خلق زر زمن كيجي
دا حکومت بیا د خلک چې تریاک ماته یې بیا د دې په ځای بدیل ورکی چا ده
نه ورکوي نه دي ورکوي الان په دې زموږ په منځ کې کې ماسو پر دنیا باندې دي خدای هیڅ شی هم نه دی ورکړی دا ولن په دې منځ کې چې سم څه چا کړی و هغه ور ماسو چې ځان یې سره سم کړی ور باندې کو پر ګول باندې و یا پر نیش باندې جوړ و و چې ور ماسو باندې پر دنیا بدل کې دي خدای شی نه دی ورکړی او هغه خلک چې ورکړي و والي حکومت و خلک چې ورکړي و حکومت له طرفه سره
Well, you can see there's a very angry man there. There's been some military onslaught on the local poppy fields. Just when they were coming ripe, they've been destroyed, whacked out. The government has failed to provide any alternative financial support. I don't know whether they thought they were going to be growing flowers or onions, or potatoes, but certainly nobody seems to be thinking along those lines. I mean, really, it's a total catastrophe, isn't it? I mean, is there anything good to be said for this policy?
Well, I think the problem before the invasion of Afghanistan was that it was always perceived as a counterinsurgency campaign, and the drugs was kind of rolled into the whole counterinsurgency activity. What the coalition forces needed to have in place if they were going to begin trying to eradicate poppy was a serious strategic approach to alternative development. That was simply not in place. The whole of the policy focus was about security, it was about trying to push the Taliban out of Afghanistan, and it was about reforming the Afghan security forces. The money that went into security should have been more focused on alternative development if the coalition forces were to break the back of this insurgency in a coherent way, in the manner that they intended to do.
Harry, it's clear from the book as it says on the back here, that America, while mouthing terrible curses on those who produce drugs in several very key production areas in the world, they're actually collaborating with them. And I mean, I'm thinking of the AUC, the right-wing movement. Not exactly, I don't know whether they'd be called terrorists, and not by America, paramilitaries, as opposed to the terrorists of the FARC, of course, yes. I mean, so America goes in and collaborates with people like that. To some extent, they even collaborated during the Vietnam War. And here I wouldn't be at all surprised if we see that there is collaboration today in Afghanistan, because it turns out that it's not the they try and blame things on the Taliban, don't they? But the truth of the matter is that everybody in Afghanistan seems to be producing drugs on whatever side of the political fence they're standing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the this was partly when the Taliban briefly put a clamp down on opium growing in order to try and curry favour with the West. They still hadn't got control of the Northern Territory, so there was opium growing going on there. I think it's important to make the point in terms of Western policy in Afghanistan that the British Army have been quite open when they're saying they're not there to destroy opium poppies. The Americans certainly are, and American contractors there certainly are, but the British have made it quite clear that they're there to deal with the Taliban. And they are not, as far as I'm aware, not engaged in the wholesale attempt to eradicate the opium poppy, because they know that without any kind of proper social infrastructure, economic infrastructure, you know, even the business of alternative crop development is going to be problematic if you haven't got. I mean, when the Russians left Afghanistan, they destroyed all the irrigation systems. There's no proper water management. there's a whole infrastructure issue there that goes even beyond the issue of alternative kind of crop development, and it's a massive issue.
We of course are talking about the international trade here, but what it comes down to in the end are drug addicts on the streets of most major cities and indeed small towns in large parts of Europe, throughout the United States, and also, it has to be said too, in the wider Middle East. It's a pretty grim, poor picture, isn't it? I mean, frankly, your book, while fascinating, was also very depressing. I just don't see a way out, frankly.
Well, I think, again, it goes back to the nature of the drugs trade in the post-Cold War period, and patterns of consumption have been transformed in the past 20 years. You know, people are taking drugs at a younger age, we have more women taking drugs, people are using more drugs, they're polydrug users. A completely different dynamic, but the real change has been in the nature of where these drugs are consumed. And traditionally, it was, you know, it was people in the West who were consuming drugs produced in the South. But what we're seeing is that drug use is now a global phenomenon. People are consuming drugs all over the world. Africa is an emerging hotspot now for the drugs trade and drug consumption. And my real concern is that unless there's proper attention to what's going on in Africa, that's going to emerge now as the next regional focus for the narcotics trade.
Harry, the main emphasis of your work, other than writing about rock stars and blues singers, is working with the drugs charity on the ground. If, as we close, you could just say what you think. I mean, I don't imagine you believe that drugs should be completely legalized.
Well, no. I mean, the Drugs Group represents a number of agencies who are dealing with this, as you say, on the front line. And I think, and I know for a fact that this book says it all, and other books have done a sort of the real basic problems with prohibition. The trouble is that, you know, nobody has really yet come up what you might call a business plan for legalization, and how you actually allow a regulated controlled market for these things like heroin and crack, very powerful drugs, without an enormous health deficit. And that's the paradox, really.
Well, that's the paradox on which we have to end this program. Alas, that's all we have time for. We've been talking about The Political Economy of Narcotics by Julia Buxton, published by Zed Books in England and Fernwood Publishing in Canada. My thanks to Julia and Harry Shapiro. We'll be back soon with another edition of Epilogue, but we're always here keen to hear what books you'd like us to review. Please email your suggestions to us at epilogue@presstv.co.uk. That's epilogue@presstv.co.uk. And as we're putting together some special programs for the end of the year, we really do need your ideas. Thanks for watching.